The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Over Europe, the night of the 2nd of May, 1945. That point of fire is a burning city. It had a 1,000 bomber raid an hour ago. And here, rolling in over the Atlantic, is a real English fog. I hope all our aircraft got home safely. Even the big ships sound frightened. Listen to all the noises in the air.
This was their final tower.
Listen.
Request your position. Come in, Lancaster.
Position nil, repeat nil. Age 27. Do you get that? That's very important. Education interrupted, violently interrupted. Religion, Church of England. Politics, conservative by nature, labor by experience. What's your name?
I cannot understand you. Hello, Lancaster. We are sending signals. Can you see our signals? Come in, Lancaster.
David Niven, hero of the classic post-war film A Matter of Life and Death. An unlikely hero, perhaps, for a contemporary Belfast poet. Nevertheless, the film was cited as one of the inspirations of Sinead Morrissey, who has just won the 2014 T.S. Eliot Poetry Prize for her collection Parallax. We'll also be talking about literary heroines with the author of a new book, Samantha Ellis. Sinead Morrissey was one of 10 poets shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. She's the first poet laureate of Northern Ireland and a reader in creative writing at the Seamus Heaney Centre in Belfast. She travelled to London's South Bank for what has become one of the buzziest occasions of the literary year, an evening of readings by the shortlisted poets hosted by the Poetry Book Society at the Festival Hall on the eve of the awards. She was introduced at the reading by Ian McMillan.
Our next reader is Sinead Morrissey from her book Parallax. And I was thinking about that word earworm, one of those sounds that you can't get out of your head. You hear a song and it won't leave you. With me, it's the theme tune of Diagnosis Murder, because all poets spend all afternoon watching telly. And with Sinead, there's a kind of equivalent of the earworm. There are poems just won't leave you. It's a kind of eye worm, or it's a brain worm. The lines stay with you. Lines like, she's learning this house like a psalm. What an amazing image. Lunar eclipse as a Chinese lantern. And not only that, not only images, but ideas as earworms are all the way through this book. Ideas about the persistence of history and how we can learn from it and what we can learn from family, how we can learn through that. And I can reveal that the last time I introduced Sinead in front of an audience was at Buckingham Palace. If that's not an earworm, I don't know what is. Sinead.
Thank you very much. I'm just going to read two poems. The first is inspired by the Moscow Puzzles, which was a book of mathematical problems published in the Soviet Union in the early 1950s, and it was a runaway success. Vitya pledges his brigade of pioneers will plant half as many fruit trees as the other pioneers. Kiryusha pledges his brigade, the best of the detachment, will match the trees of all brigades together, including Vitya's. Their brigades work the last shift simultaneously. The preceding brigades of the detachment plant 40 trees. Both pledges are fulfilled exactly. How many trees does the whole detachment plant? Answer. a kind of Latin, finished and intricate, or a box of glass plate negatives from 1887, unearthed by accident of Newcastle Cloth Market. The oceanic white tip shark. Ectoplasm. Natasha Ivanova on her collective farm, working out the most efficient way to harvest cotton. The actual answer is 136. And the next and last poem is inspired by the film A Matter of Life and Death, which many of you may already know. It was released in Britain in 1946, just after the Second World War, and it shows two worlds. This world, which is filmed in glorious Technicolor, and an afterlife, which is filmed in black and white. And there's an enormous moving stairway which links the two worlds. And I happened to catch sight of this film when I was going into labour with the birth of my first child, which, if it hadn't have happened, is a coincidence I would have to have invented. A Matter of Life and Death. On the afternoon I'm going into labour, so haltingly it's still easy to bend and breathe, each time the erratic clamp sets its grip about my pelvis, then releases. I take a nap, eat lunch, and while you pen a letter to our impending offspring explaining who we are, what there is on offer in the house we don't yet know we'll leave, to be handed over on his 18th birthday like a key to the domain. Sit front to back on an upright chair in the living room and switch on the television. World War II. David Niven is faltering after a bombing op in a shot-up plane. Conservative by nature, Labour by conviction. He quotes Sir Walter Raleigh, "Oh, give me my scallop shell of quiet, my staff of faith to walk upon," while a terrified American radio girl listens in. It's all fire and ravenous engine noise. He can't land because the fuselage is damaged and he hasn't a parachute. Then, because he'd rather fall than fry, he bails out anyway, a blip on the screen vanishing into cloud cover. The girl hides her face in her hands. The baby drops a fraction of an inch and the next contraction hurts. I know I'm at the gentlest end of an attenuated scale of pain relief, climbing the stairs, a bath, two aspirin, tapering down as the hours roll on and we relocate to hospital, to gas and air, pethidine, a needle in the spine, and go out to walk the sunny verges of our cul-de-sac like a wind-up fat man toy, tottering every 5 minutes or so into a bow. Nobody's home. The bins are still out on the road after this morning's pickup. The light aslant and filled with running gold. Back inside, the film has switched to Technicolor monochrome, an anachronistic afterlife in grey in which dead airmen sign in under name and rank. The Yanks smack gum and swagger, "Isn't this swell?" and a legion of otherworldly women with hair rolled high as dunes hand out enormous plaster wings to the just deceased. The dead are invoiced for, like battleships or teapots, their names on the list ticked off as they swing through each allotted doorway, clean and whole and orderly, the incomprehensible machinery of life and death, a question of books that balance. And there's this sudden tug inside, rigging, straining taut and singing, and I cry out for the first time. And in you come to coax and soothe as though I'm doing something, running a marathon, climbing a mountain, instead of being forced back down into my seat by some psychopathic schoolmarm over and over again, "Stay." And I think of my granny and her 46 hours of agony, shifting my mother from one world to the next, and how that birth cut short her happiness at the Raleigh bicycle factory in Nottingham, where her youth was spent in secret war work, typing up invoices. back in heaven, there's about as much commotion as there's been in a million years. A slight shake of the head by the woman in charge, a sigh, because David Niven, who should have arrived but hasn't, landed on a beach and, how, survived, met the American radio operator as she cycled home after the night shift, and fell in love. He must be sent for. Down below, they're already looking post-coital, picnicking in civvies on a homespun tartan rug in a technicolour rose garden. I'm not supposed to show up at the hospital for hours, or not until the cervix has done its slow, industrial cranking wide, enough to be marked by a thumb span. And the problem is, I don't know what this means, or how to tell, or how much worse the pain is going to get, answer a lot, and so the afternoon grows hot and narrow and you abandon your confessions altogether, and the botched clock of paradise with seven hands across its face ticks on the wall. I've seen it many times, said my granny. When a new life comes into a family, an old life goes out, as though there were checks and balances. Birth weighted against death like a tidy invoice and a precise amount of room allotted the living. Before we inch upstairs to the bathroom to test what sweet relief is granted after all by a bath and lavender oil, I catch sight of a magical marble escalator, the original stairway to heaven, with David Niven captive on its steps being hauled away to the sound of a clanking bell from his radiant girlfriend. And I imagine my granny, who died 3 weeks ago on a hospital ward in Chesterfield, making room as she herself predicted. Not dumb and stricken and hollowed out with cancer, but young, glamorous, childless, free. In her 1940s shoes and sticky lipstick, clicking about the office of new arrivals as though she owns it, flicking open the leather-bound ledger and asking him to sign. Thank you.
Lancaster.
You seem like a nice girl. I can't give you my position. Instruments gone, crew gone too. All except Bob here, my Sparks. He's dead. The rest all bailed out on my orders. Time 0335. You get that?
Crew bailed out 0335. Are you all right? Are you going to try to land? Do you want to fix?
Name's not G. George. It's P. Peter. Peter D. Carter. D's for David. Squadron leader Peter Carter. No, I'm not going to land. Undercarriage is gone. Inner port's on fire. I'm bailing out presently. I'm bailing out. Take a telegram.
Got your message.
Summers ago, I was on the Yorkshire Moors, arguing over the Wuthering with my best friend about whether we'd rather be Jane Eyre or Cathy Earnshaw. I thought Cathy, obviously Cathy, the point of this walk, this pilgrimage, was to see the ruins of the farmhouse that inspired Wuthering Heights, which loomed at us promisingly from the top. We'd both, without consulting each other, worn lace-edged t-shirts in honour of the occasion, and after stopping off for supplies in Haworth, here we were at last, and it was just as I'd imagined. All rain-green moorland, spiky heather, a turbulent waterfall, and signs beguilingly translated into Japanese. The Brontes are big in Japan. It was supposed to be Emily Bronte's favourite walk. She was an inveterate walker, always out in all weathers. Once she found a merlin hawk in an abandoned nest and brought him home. She called him Hero, or possibly Nero. No one can read her handwriting. She painted a watercolour of him, and in her poem, The Caged Bird, she imagined him longing for Earth's breezy hills and heaven's blue sea. And in fact, he did escape, while she was away studying in Brussels, and when she got back, she could find no trace of him. I hoped we might see a hawk, but I was excited just to be there on the moor Emily had walked, the moor Kathy spends whole days out on and haunts after her death. I was just about managing to stop myself from yelling out to Heathcliff that it was me, Kathy, coming home, so stoic, virtuous, plain Jane Eyre was very much not on my mind. But Emma argued that Jane was independent, she knew who she was, she didn't suffer fools, and she stuck to her principles, and Kathy's just silly. Ignoring my howls of fury, she continued, "She's always weeping and wailing, and she says she loves Heathcliff, but she marries the rich boy because she's a snob, and that makes everyone unhappy." I defended Kathy. "She's passionate and headstrong and gorgeous. You can't just like her because she's pretty," said Emma. "All right, but Kathy doesn't mean to marry the wrong man. She's pushed into it, and she regrets it, doesn't she?" Emma asked, "Why not just not marry the wrong man?" I was thrown. Emma had been my best friend since we were 11, which meant we'd been lending each other books and passionately discussing them for over 20 years. She'd introduced me to J.D. Salinger. I'd introduced her to Antonia White. We had once spent a whole week lying side by side on a beach, both reading War and Peace. We didn't always agree. Not agreeing was part of the fun. But this was different. Kathy's claims to my loyalty were strong. I'd known her almost as long as I'd known Emma, since I first read Wuthering Heights at 12. She had been my favourite literary heroine, the undisputed queen. Kathy and Emma had both been there for me at dark times, and Kathy had even supported some of my more impulsive romantic decisions which Emma had advised against. I was looking forward to seeing Kathy's house. Yes, it was ruined. Yes, I would have to imagine the window ledges with her name scratched over and over in the paint, but at least I would feel the north wind blowing over the edge and see the gaunt thorns all stretching their limbs one way as if craving arms of the sun. But when we reached Top Withens, the skies cleared, the clouds vanished, and the sun shone as if this was the backdrop for some moment of revelation. Which it was. I was wrong. My whole life, I'd been trying to be Kathy when I should have been trying to be Jane. As we leaned against the warm stone, basking, actually basking in the sun, drinking flasks of tea, I wondered why I'd written Jane off. She is independent and brave and clever, and she really does stay true to herself. And while Kathy ends up a wandering ghost, Jane ends up happily married. The brilliant sunshine was very Jane weather, I thought, pleasant, clear and rational. It would have rained for Kathy. There would have been thunder and lightning. "Anne," said a small but firm Jane voice, "we would have shivered and eaten soggy sandwiches hunched under the hoods of our waterproofs." The Bronte Society had put a plaque on the ruin, warning over-eager fans that Top Withens wasn't actually Wuthering Heights, and even before it was ruined, the farmhouse bore no resemblance to the house in the novel, although they did concede the situation may have been in her mind. It felt like a corrective to romance, a prompt to question old assumptions. I decided that when I got back to London, I would dig out my old copies of Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre and read them again, with more scrutiny and less sentiment. I would find out how I really felt about Kathy and Jane, but maybe that wouldn't be the end of it. After all, if I'd been wrong about Kathy, had I been wrong about my other heroines too?
That was Samantha Ellis reading the opening chapter of How to Be a Heroine, or What I've Learnt from Reading Too Much. Welcome, Samantha. Do you feel your life's been a journey that you could sort of chart your life in heroines?
Yes, I don't know if I felt that before I started rereading, but once I did, I definitely felt like I was telling the story of my life. I was reading the story of my life through my heroines, and it sort of surprised me. When I began this, I felt like I didn't really have a story. Like, I didn't sort of have a narrative arc. I didn't have a sort of journey. I was sort of formless, whereas I had all these strong, powerful heroines who seemed to have a sort of beginning, a middle, and an end. And now I sort of feel I have got a bit of an arc.
Tell us a bit about your own background, because one of the things you do in this book is you mix different storytelling cultures.
My family are Iraqi Jews. My parents were both refugees from Baghdad. My father left in 1951, my mother in 1971. So they were quite recent refugees, and I was growing up in London in a very tight-knit community. And all the women in my community, most of the women in my community, were housewives and mothers, and they married quite young. And I sort of knew that my happy ending was supposed to be marriage to a nice Iraqi Jewish boy. And I knew I didn't want it, but I didn't know what I did want. So I was sort of actively looking for women who had different lives and did different things.
There are some heroes in here, aren't there? And you're also re-evaluating what Mr. Right might be. So Darcy is a bad man, really, isn't he?
Well, I suppose I just wish I could tell my younger self, you know, not all arrogant men are secretly nice. You know, he does turn good in the end, Darcy. You know, at the end, they sort of got this sort of what sounds like a very sort of happy marriage, and She's teaching him to have a sense of humour, and I sort of think that might be quite lovely, but he really, you know, the first time they meet, he says she's not pretty enough to dance with.
That's so much for Jane Austen's Lizzie Bennet and Darcy. It, really interestingly, later on you discover Flora Post from Cold Comfort Farm, and you say that she's your first comic heroine since Lizzie Bennet. I was really interested in that.
Well, I suppose I went through a phase of liking these sort of suffering heroines like Esther Greenwood from The Bell Jar and heroines who really struggled like Scarlett O'Hara. She's not happy through much of Gone with the Wind. And then I got to Flora Post and she just makes things happen for herself and for other people. She's comic in both senses. She's very funny, but she also creates these happy endings for herself and for everyone else.
You mentioned Gone with the Wind there. There's another bit of your revisionism on heroes. You say, there was a time when, unable to see what a tool Ashley is, I thought impossible love was the best kind. But I hope I'm braver in love now. I'm tempted to make a rule that any heroine who spends a novel in love with someone who can't or won't love her back is not truly a heroine. That sort of pretty much gets rid of most of literature, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose I now see that Scarlett O'Hara spends a lot of the novel. I mean, she's got a lot going on. She's supporting her entire family through famine and war. But she does, during this, spend a lot of time not awake to her own heart and not really realising that Rhett Butler, who is an amazing hero and not just gorgeous, but is the man who understands her most and who really will bring her out of herself and make her much happier than she can ever be. And she likes this kind of awful, dull guy, Ashley. I just wish she was awake to it more. And I think, yeah, spending an entire novel in unrequited love with someone is a bit of a shame. It's a bit of a waste of your life, isn't it, as a woman?
But she taught you to flirt.
I'm not very good at flirting, but what I know from Scarlett O'Hara, she sort of bats her eyelashes, and there's a lot of things about how to walk in a hoop skirt not so helpful in
She's
the 80s.
Very useful.
I mean, one thing I was a bit sad about is that she sort of says that Melanie, who I now think is quite an amazing heroine, sort of in her sort of shadow, Melanie talks to boys about books, and Scarlett O'Hara just thinks this is ridiculous. What on earth is she doing? What a blue stocking. But actually, I quite like talking to boys about books.
There are some disappointments in your rereading, aren't there? You are disappointed by The Little Women.
Yes, it's so much preachier than I remembered. I remember Jo March as being this kind of rebel, and she dresses like a boy, and she's a writer, and she's really tough and fun. And she sort of is those things, but the whole book, it seems to be about taming these women and taming these girls, and becoming a woman means becoming tamer, becoming less yourself. And she gives up writing when she marries this boring old professor.
And so, similar thing happens with Anne of Green Gables, who is my favourite. That green hair moment is sort of etched on my soul.
Yeah, she also gives up writing, which actually I didn't remember. There was a shock when I was rereading it, but she's the heroine who made me a writer. And it's in the sequels. After she marries Gilbert, lovely Gilbert Blythe, she gives up writing and she becomes sort of really smug married. In the final book, in Rilla of Ingleside, she's referred to as Mrs. Blythe. She's not even Anne anymore. In the narration, she's Mrs. Blythe. And someone says to her, "Are you still writing?" And she says, "Oh, I'm writing living epistles now." And she says, she sort of gestures at her children.
I'm going to bring in Lisa Allardyce now, who's editor of Guardian Review and another connoisseur of literary heroines. Lisa, are you a stoic, virtuous Jane Eyre type or a weepy, waily Cathy Earnshaw?
Well, I think very much being a bookish girl has been disastrous on my life in more ways than my mother, when she was very used to boast about the number of books I'd read. I think exactly the same, you know, was with Cathy all the way. One book which was a late discovery for me was The Pursuit of Love, the last line where she says, you know, "Darling, it's always a disappointment," from the Bolter. and the comic heroines and the way in which one only learns, I think I'd have taken it terribly seriously had I read it as a teenager when I was still with the Whalers. I have to say that few recently published books have infuriated me and made me as angry as your book, mainly because it's such a brilliant idea for a book, and also because I felt as if you were sort of snooping in my teenage diaries. I mean, so much of it was so close to me. I mean, they're all there, all of my favourites. And the girls from Ballyshoes, what Katie did, all of them. It's wonderful. And it's infuriating because all you want to do is go back and lock yourself up and reread all of them immediately.
Well, it was a very nice 18 months, I have to say. I would recommend it to anyone. I had a very nice time. I'm actually most of the reading and writing in bed. I didn't leave the house. It was great. It was very relaxing.
Now, we've mentioned that you're Iraqi Jewish, and I wondered the extent to which that cultural impinges on your reading. Now, you have this thing about fudwa, is it?
It means I would die for you, and it's I'm going to...
Your gran says it something like 15 times.
My grandma says it on the end of almost every sentence, bless her. And it is the thing that you say all the time, and or I don't say it, but we are quite a melodramatic community and a sort of storytelling community. You know, that my family were really good at telling stories. They taught me more about telling stories than anyone else. I used to sit under the table, under the kitchen table, and I used to pull the stalks off the parsley so we could make tabbouleh and pass it up to them, and they'd be doing one would be doing the tomatoes and one would be doing the onions and so on. I used to hear these stories above my head, and those are the first stories I heard.
It's not by coincidence that your final heroine is Scheherazade.
I should have found her sooner. She's Middle Eastern, she's a storyteller, and she's got this great line which I never noticed before in the frame narrative, where she says that the reason she's doing it for myself and my sisters, and she uses the word sisters plural, and she doesn't mean just her sister who comes in with her and sits in the bedroom with the king, who is otherwise going to kill her in the morning and has been killing the women of his country. She doesn't just mean that one sister, she means all the women who would otherwise be killed by this, you know, homicidal maniac of a king. And she sort of heals him through storytelling, and she becomes the queen. It's sort of an amazing, liberating journey, I think.
On the thing of sisters, I loved how you said that the sisters literally come out of the waves for the Little Mermaid to say, you know, stop it, you can come back.
Yeah, it literally is the sisterhood. But again, that's something I didn't notice. I mean, there's a lot of things that I sort of feel like maybe I can get more layers out of these books.
Absolutely.
Than I do.
I was equally obsessed with Scarlet Hair. I mean, wonderful Vivien Leigh and Clark Gable look nothing like they did in my imaginations, and refused to watch the film. But what is really interesting, I think, is that in many ways, Scarlet is the most abysmal feminist role model. I mean, she cinches her waist in, she pretends to be more stupid than she is. She's so unsisterly to the point of bitchiness. And yet somehow or other, in her positivity and her refusal to be done over, she is something of a sort of feminist role model, isn't she?
She's really tough. And yeah, I mean, she steals her sister's man, and she's a terrible person in lots of ways. And yeah, very unsisterly. But she could just support herself through the war and what comes afterwards. She doesn't. She stays on it in Atlanta when the city is on fire in order to make sure that Melanie's baby is delivered okay. And then she gets her out and gets her to her childhood home, where she looks after her and her whole family and a whole load of hangers-on who really, if she was really ruthless, she would just go, right, okay, I'm just going to look after myself, or me and Ashley, who I fancy, and no one else.
I've been thinking about heroes all day today, because I was wondering if a sort of male experience of reading is different. And I've been trying to think if there are male heroes who I love. You do want to be them. I mean, it's very strange wanting to be sort of Olivia Newton-John and Wonder Woman and sort of Jane Eyre and Kathy at the same time.
While I was writing this book, I talked to my male friends, and they seemed to think that they wanted to read the book as teenagers that no one else was reading. Whereas I remember all my friends wanted to be reading the same book so we could all talk about it. And it's a much more sort of communal activity reading, I think, for girls. Now I think it's a bit more refracted and we slightly read different things. But I certainly, when I finish a book, I want to immediately get my best friend to read it, so
Where
then
were
talk
you
about
when
it.
I was growing up, I didn't know any.
You missed out on
I know, this would have been wonderful. I nearly cut my hair off, and also I went for several months refusing to look in a mirror like Maggie Tulliver. You're not a big George Eliot fan, are you? She's not there.
She's not there, no. I'm not.
I went through a terribly Puritan streak in my George Eliot faith.
There was so much I had to, so many people I had to leave out, but she just wasn't massively influential on me as a girl.
We mentioned a little bit about how your readings have changed. And one of the books that your interpretation has changed about is The Bell Jar.
Well, when I first read The Bell Jar, I first encountered Sylvia Plath, and I became completely obsessed with her as a teenager. And I was obsessed with her and with Esther Greenwood from The Bell Jar. And wrongly, I think, I got from her the impression that to become a woman, you had to suffer. You had to go through some kind of crucible of pain and suffering, and you would come out the other side sort of purified. And this is a sort of the Sylvia Plath cult, and I think a lot of people do go with it. Anyway, I went back to Sylvia Plath, and there's loads of really positive stuff in The Bell Jar and in the poems. Yeah, there's a bit early on where Esther Greenwood says that she still has some of the stuff that she had from when she was in New York when she fell apart. And something she'd given it to her baby to play with, one of these things, and I thought, oh, She gets through it. She has a baby who she's kind of able to revisit her past with, you know, find these old things that have from a time of great pain for her. I mean, and given to her to play with, it's incredibly joyous. And in the poems as well, I really like Frieda Hughes's re-edit of Ariel, and that begins, I think, with the word love and ends with the word spring. It's much more optimistic and positive.
That's Frieda Hughes, Sylvie Plath's daughter.
Yes, we don't know exactly how Plath wanted it to be laid out, but there's arguments for it to be laid out that way, and that it was intended to be a book of poetry that wasn't a suicide note, but was actually about the fact that she's had this terrible breakup and she was trying to move forward and come through it. I mean, it's very sad that she didn't, but she did try, I think, to write Ariel as a book of poetry that ended up telling the story of her escape from her pain, really.
Now, that makes the point that there's a difference between the author as heroine and the characters as heroine. Are there a lot of authors who you see as heroines, or is it mainly something that is within the realm of fiction?
I ended up reading a lot about the authors. Some of them I knew about already, and some of them I didn't. Because I was angry, you know, why, Ellen Montgomery, did you sell Anne of Green Gables short? Why did you not let her carry on writing?
Did you read the Emily books as well?
I did. Well, only, you know, when I came to this book.
She sticks with it slightly longer, I think, doesn't she?
But you don't
love her quite as much as Anne, I do.
She's not as, you know, warm and...
She hasn't got red hair.
But Ellen Montgomery wrote those books, the Emily trilogy, because she was just kind of fed up with having created Anne, who was just slightly too sweet, slightly too lovely. And she just thought she wants to create a heroine who was like she was as a girl, much fiercer, much tougher, much more ambitious than Emily is. So sometimes I was reading to find out about that. But I mean, to take Ellen Montgomery as an example, she was incredibly brave. She had a very tough life, full of sort of duty and sacrifice. She, like Anne and like a lot of her other heroines, was a semi-orphan, brought up by her grandparents, who never really mellowed towards her. So she's sort of writing wish fulfillment, and she didn't have a happy marriage. So that's why the marriage doesn't really seem to... You don't really believe in Gilbert and Anne, I don't think, because she just couldn't really write one.
I went through a dreadfully protracted Virginia Woolf phase as well, which wasn't cheery, which you seem to have been spared, did you?
I very much enjoyed The Lighthouse, which, again, Lily Briscoe is pretty much the only happy spinster heroine that I found.
Everybody's so awful to her.
Everyone's awful to her, but at the end, I mean, because of the way it's written, you don't get as much of her. You don't get, you know, you're sort of glimpsing.
And Mrs. Ramsay is so perfect.
And I mean, I like the idea of being Mrs. Ramsay, being this kind of matriarch and cooking all these meals and having this wonderful house that everyone wants to come to,
Lily
and spreading
Briscoe
all this joy.
Actually has something to do with
God, I mean, she went to stay with Mrs. Ramsay, and she's coming into your bedroom at night going, okay, now, you really have to think about getting married. What? I'm on holiday. You don't come into your guests' bedrooms at night and dictate to them. Anyway, and then Lily Briscoe at the end, she finishes the painting, and she has this enormous sense of relief that she doesn't need to marry anyone. And William Banks, who everyone has been going on about her to marry the whole time, and they don't fancy each other, their friendship has, she says, become one of the pleasures of her life. I mean, this sort of male-female friendship is just very kind of unusual in literature and sort of lovely. So she ends up on her own, happy as an artist, surrounded by friends. I don't know, I really massively like Lily Briscoe.
Now, the subtitle of this book is a riff on the Alcott quote, she is too fond of books and it has turned her brain, which I have on a mug in my kitchen. Do you think your family would think that your reading has turned your brain? Have you strayed from the course that was set out for you, or are they very perfectly happy?
Come to terms with the fact that I didn't marry a nice Iraqi Jewish boy, and actually my family, I'm very close to my family, and they love the book, which is a relief. As a child, I was told often this story about my grandmother's mother, who was taken out of school, I think at 14, because reading was spoiling her eyes, too much reading was spoiling her eyes, and that she wouldn't get married if she had to wear glasses. And I was told this often when I had a book in my hand, and I just remember thinking that it was, you know, one or the other, really, but I had chosen books at that point. But no, my family have come round to reading and to what it's done for me, really.
Could there be a better subject for a books podcast? How to Be a Heroine is published by Chatto and Windus.
Thanks to Samantha Ellis and Lisa Allardyce. Thanks also to the Royal Festival Hall at the South Bank Centre and the Poetry Book Society for their recording of Sinead Morrissey reading her poems. There's much more poetry to be read and heard at www.poetrybooks.co.uk. Whatever your taste in literature is, you'll find something to suit it in our podcast series. So why not subscribe at theguardian.com/books? From me, Claire Armistead, and producer Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.